Hi, I'm Susie Larson. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast from Live the Promise. There are many more podcasts available up on the website at myfaithradio.com, and your support makes this possible. Thank you. Good afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise. And we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. So glad you tuned in, and a very happy Friday to you. Always, always honored to do this journey with you. Well, in just a moment, you'll hear my conversation with Mahtab Mahmoudi. And she and her mother fled Iran, and their amazing escape is the story behind the film from years ago. Maybe you saw it, Not Without My Daughter. I held my breath the whole time I watched that movie for the first time. Well, you'll hear that story in just a moment. And a reminder that this whole program is up at our website at myfaithradio.com. I am telling you, you won't be able to stop thinking about this story. And you may even want to share it with someone through email, Facebook, or Twitter after the show airs. Well, then, second hour, Angela Waite joins me to share her story of losing her young son and how God met and ministered to her family in the midst of heartbreaking loss. She really shares some equipping advice, too, for how you show up with people whose hearts are broken. Two very powerful hours ahead. Just a few quick announcements first, if you don't mind. A special shout out to our listeners in Madison, Wisconsin, who listen in on Faith 1190. Do you know we all now have an FM translator in your area? You can hear us loud and clear 24/7. Check us out on the FM dial 104.7. That's 104.7 FM in Madison. So excited about that. And if you're new to Faith Radio, we'd love to send you a new listener welcome packet. You can call us at 877-933-2484 or go online, myfaithradio.com. Request that listener packet. We'll get you that information ASAP. Would love to get that information out to you. We're so excited to have you be part of the family. Also, very excited to be partnering with FEBC again this year. And you know, One Radio will provide the gospel for 25 people in hard-to-reach areas. If you have $30 to spare, if you want to invest in the gospel of Jesus Christ around the world, go to givearadio.org. Let me tell you about my guest, and we'll get her on the show. A Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Michigan State University, Mahtab Mahmoudi has worked in the field of mental health and is an advocate for public awareness of health and welfare initiatives. She's represented by AEI Speakers Bureau, lives in Michigan, and frequently travels to share her story with audiences around the world. Mahtab, so nice to meet you. And I actually want you to know I've prayed for you over the years when I've thought about you after thinking about your gripping story.
That means so much to me. Thank you. And that's one of the amazing blessings that's come from this. People for years have stood in line to have their book signed, mom's book signed, and shared with us that they have prayed. And that's just what an amazing gift that is. I appreciate that.
Well, Mahtab, before we get into your amazing story, we just love to start out all of our conversations on Live the Promise talking scripture, wondering if you either have a life verse or just even a verse you've been thinking about these days that you can share with us.
I do. I was thinking about what's going on in the world right now. There are so many troubles and tribulations and so much darkness. And this, the words of Jesus from the book of John have been coming to mind a lot. John 16, verse 33. Let's see. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart. I have overcome the world. And that's a passage I've memorized in my youth, but now looking it up, I see the words just immediately preceding this say something beautiful about our Savior, too. It says, I have told you these things. He's talking about trials, and he says, I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart. I have overcome the world. So, beautiful promise from our Savior, indeed. And it holds true yet today.
Indeed, indeed. So, Mahtab, as much as you can remember, tell us about your life in the States before you left for Iran.
Well, I remember quite a bit. I had a good life. Lots of love. There were a lot of wonderful, loving, nurturing people in my life. My parents had a good relationship, and they set a really good example for me of what a loving home life is. We had a lot of company around, and shared a lot of meals. And the culture where I grew up in, sharing a meal with somebody is a very important thing. And we shared a lot of meals with loved ones and laughed and talked and really became family over meals. And I had a lot of really great memories. And even last weekend, I had the honor of going back to the small town in northern Michigan where my family lived before we went to Iran. And they did there was a great bookstore there. They did a book launch for me. And the town just showed up, and they all had beautiful memories of how much my dad loved me and my mom and their memories of our family life together, which is so important. I appreciated so much that they held on to those good memories.
Amazing. And so for those who've not seen the film, Not Without My Daughter, bring us back to that time, because while you were still in the U.S., your dad started to change and shift, and you started to see him transform, and it almost seems like on a dime. What instigated that change in him?
Well, around the time I was born, I was born around the time of the Iranian Revolution. So just right after I was born, several weeks after I was born, the American embassy hostage taking occurred. And, the Shah was ousted, Khomeini took over the country, and things changed a lot in Iran. And I think that a lot of people who were living, a lot of Iranians who were living around the world, then felt the surge of nationalism and felt like they needed to do something, but didn't necessarily understand the changes that were taking place. And so at that time, from what I understand, from what relatives and friends and mom have shared with me over the years, is my dad changed really dramatically at that time. My parents were living in Texas then, and my dad began not going out in the streets and protesting, but organizing the protests. And so these Iranian students would meet at our house, and he would fund their protests. And there's a picture of me when I was an infant in the arms of a man whose head is bandaged, and he had been stabbed in the head in one of these protests. This is the stuff my dad was involved with. And my mom was scared and said, this is not how I want to raise our daughter. So she was going to get a divorce. And he said no. He would leave all of this behind. They moved to Michigan to make a fresh start. And she thought that he had left all of that behind. And so during my early childhood memories, I wasn't aware of these things. This was all happening around the time of my birth. And when I was old enough to remember my earliest childhood memories, he was living as though he had left that behind, although he hadn't in reality. And in reality, he was planning to take us to Iran. He liked life in America, and he was really making the most of that, but he didn't want me to be indoctrinated into this culture. And so just before I was to start school is when he took us to Iran.
You even say that this was like a pure evil genius plan, because he convinced your mom to take a two-week vacation with him and with you to his homeland, but then you'd come back and build your mom's dream home, which explained why it seemed okay to have all the belongings packed up and ready to ship. I mean, I gasped when I read that, because she was feeling maybe a little tentative, and he's saying, no, let's just go take this vacation. Let's pack up the house. When we come back, then it'll be easy to move. Take it from there.
That's true. So we went to Iran for this vacation. Mom was afraid to go because she thought when we went, he would keep us there. But she didn't know of any other situation like this. And she sought legal help from some friends of ours who were attorneys. They knew the family well, and they told her that this doesn't happen. My dad would never do something like this. And she needed a psychiatrist, not a lawyer. And so she was afraid if she didn't go, he would kidnap me, and she would never get me back, never rescue me. And so she went. And for the first 2 weeks, it was a normal family vacation. Everything went fairly well. There were huge culture shocks, but it was very much a celebration. And then at the end of the 2 weeks, he told us that we weren't coming home. We were in Iran until we died.
And in your little mind, you're 5 years old at this point. How did you process that? Because you started to see the growing tension of how your dad turned on your mom and started to treat her, emotionally and physically abusively. How did you process that?
Well, from that moment on, from the moment he told us we couldn't come home, he was a different person. And to me, it was as though my dad died right then. I'd been quite close with him before. And from that time on, you know, it's hard to explain just how completely he changed. But what stands out in my mind is that even the sound of his footsteps was different. I would hear him coming down the hall and I would be terrified because his footsteps were so angry and forceful and deliberate. And, I was really afraid that the next time he came into the room would be the time he killed my mom.
Here's a quote from your book. Not a day passed without me begging my mom to take me home and her promising that she would. We prayed continually for God to open a door for us and trusted that somehow he would. Even worse than not being able to go home was the fear that now my dad was going to kill my mom because I'd forgotten to forget and had said something I wasn't supposed to say. I don't want to get ahead too much, but I want you to comment on that. Mm-hmm. Again, your little precious little mind and heart and soul, you know, feeling the unrest and the fear of how drastically your life had changed. And when you were walking with your mom and dad, and it was one of those rare moments of normalcy between them, or sometimes he would blast off in these fits of rage, you saw birds and you made a comment that triggered something in your dad. Take us to that moment, if you would.
Mm-hmm. I felt like a great responsibility to protect my mom. And I think that's something common among children who grow up in an abusive home. You know, there is this need to be a protector. And so I was very cautious about what I said. I knew what mom and I were doing to try to escape. I knew who we were talking with. I knew about all the plans that had been in the works over the many months that had fallen through. And the school would not let mom leave with me. She had to go to school with me because I was so distraught at the thought of being separated that I would just cry and scream all day long. So she would stay with me. Well, they would let us arrive late. So often in the morning when we would walk to school, we would first go and meet with the people who were trying to help us. Well, that morning we had seen these birds. And in my mind, I remember them as peacocks, but I have no idea why there would be peacocks on the streets in Tehran. Mm. Probably they were not peacocks. And then that evening, my family was walking together, and this was not on the path that we should have taken to school, and the birds were still there. And I said, oh, the birds are still here, the birds we saw this morning. And right away, my dad said, what? What do you mean you saw these birds this morning? You didn't see these birds this morning? And I said, yes, we were walking and we saw these birds this morning on the way to school. Well, it wasn't on the way to school. And my mom was squeezing my hand and I'm looking at her and saying, why are you squeezing my hand?
And, oh, my.
So I might, you know, I didn't catch on as quickly as they caught on that, you know, I had just let something very important slip. And that was the only time I remember during those 18 months in Iran that I did slip up like that. But it was something that was very much a part of my mindset, is I had to be so careful to not say something that would get us in trouble.
Did your mom pay a price for that, or how did your dad end up reacting to that information?
She did. She did. I don't remember exactly, but I'm sure he beat her when we got home. Mm. You know, but yeah.
My goodness. Talking to Mahtab Mahmoudi, the title of her book is My Name is Mahtab, The Story That Began in the Global Phenomenon, Not Without My Daughter, continues. When we come back, Mahtab will share about how her mom got ill. And Mahtab wondered if she was going to live or die and what that would mean for her own story. Don't go away. More with Mahtab Mahmoudi when we return. Walking through a deep, dark valley of the shadow, and you wonder where God is. You don't sense him. You're not hearing him. Know this, he will never leave you. He is with you. He goes before you. He's got your back. His hand of blessing is on your head. That's what Scripture says. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. Really glad you tuned in today. You're going to hear a story of a woman who's walked through the valley of the shadow, and God has redeemed her story, and it's a gripping story. Talking today to Mata Mahmoudi, and if you ever saw the film way back when titled Not Without My Daughter, Sally Field was the star in that, rescuing her daughter from Iran. But Mahtab has an American-born mom and an Iranian father, and they lived in the States till Mahtab was a young girl, and they, long story short, went back to Iran and were supposed to be there for a two-week vacation, but the father's plan all along was to keep them there and hold them captive, and he became an abusive, emotionally, physically abusive husband to Mahtab's mom. And so Mahtab's mom was making a plan to escape, and she could have left on her own, but she wouldn't leave without her daughter. Mahtab's book is My Name is Mahtab, The Story That Began in the Global Phenomenon, Not Without My Daughter, continues. We've got a few copies to get into your hands, only a few copies. I want you to email me. We're not taking phone calls today. Susie@myfaithradio.com. You can put Not Without My Daughter or My Name is Mahtab, whatever's easiest for you to remember. Give me your mailing address, and a few of you will get a copy of Mahtab's gripping book. You will not be able to put it down, I'm just saying. So we get to this point in the story, Mahtab, when you're in Iran. I think you'd been there for a few weeks, and your mother took ill. Take it from there.
She did. She became very ill and weak, and I was her protector. I would sit by her bedside and stand guard, and she begged me. You know, she was kind of drifting in and out, and when she would wake up, she would beg me to not let my dad give her a shot. He was an anesthesiologist, and he had threatened that, you know, he could kill her. One injection, and she would be dead. And so I would stand guard and watch to make sure he couldn't give her an injection. Mm. And sometimes he would force me to, you know, leave her bedroom and you know, interact with the other children, with my cousins. And so I would always leave my bunny behind to, you know, stay with her, and I would make sure I was in a spot where I could see the door, see if he was approaching, and that was very much a dark time. And Mom says that, you know, there came a day where she found a gum wrapper, and she tried to write her name on the gum wrapper, but she was too weak to do even that, and she realized that she was going to die and leave me there to grow up thinking that this way of life, you know, the way my dad was treating her, the way he was treating me, the way his family was helping him and all of this was normal. Not so much the Iranian way of life, the abusive way of life, you know, but this was what is normal in life, and she didn't want that for me, and so that was her motivation to try to get better. And so she came up with a new plan and decided she was going to kill everybody with kindness and earn their trust. And maybe by earning their trust, she could earn some freedom, and that would lead to escape.
Really is amazing when you think of the kind of grit that woman had. I mean, truly, to fight for you, to fight for the freedom and to not give up. And I mean, it was such a despairing situation. There's another story in the book that just, again, made me gasp when, in a fit of rage, your father grabbed your mom by the hair and started to smash her head into the wall. And his family members just stood around and watched this. And you, as a little, what, five-year-old, are throwing yourself in the midst of that, trying to stop your dad from hurting your mom. Do you have any idea, first of all, what sparked that particular outburst?
I don't. You know, it was, we were always walking on eggshells around him. Sometimes there was, I mean, nothing about it is logical.
Yeah.
You know, abusing another person is not logical. But sometimes there would be no obvious provocation. It was just a switch would flip and he was off on one of these tirades. But I don't remember exactly what led to that precise incident.
Mm. Absolutely amazing. And one more thing, we're taking a break here in just a few minutes, and I just want our friends to know on the other side of the break, we're going to hear about the escape, what life's been like for Mahtab since she's been in the U.S. We're going to get to that. But thought this was interesting, too, that your dad forced your mom to send letters back to the family in America with pictures to give the appearance that all was well. Did friends and family in the U.S. have any sense that something was up?
They did. They didn't know the extent of what was happening, but you know, my brother said after we escaped that it was so hard to go to bed every night and not know if we were dead or if we were alive or if we would ever come home. Mm. So, I mean, they clearly knew something was wrong, but they didn't know exactly what was happening.
Mm. Wow, just absolutely amazing. So in your mom's really brilliant tenacity, I mean, your dad had his own tenacity, but so did your mom, and she towed the line and eventually thought your dad would feel like shopping because he wouldn't even let you guys go to the marketplace without him, but she kind of thought, well, this will be beneath him eventually, this will wear him out, and it did, and he didn't want to do such activities, so he did slowly loosen the reins. You and your mom got to go to the marketplace on your own. You said you don't believe in coincidences, only miracles. I want you to talk about that first miracle that your mama encountered when she was looking for a payphone, one of those days when you and her were out on your own.
Mm-hmm. So that day I wasn't actually with her, but there was a special coin needed for the payphone, and she was going into the shops begging for this coin. And one of the shop owners recognized her accent and said, oh, you're American, come use my phone. And she called the embassy. We had escaped from the house once before and made it to the Swiss embassy because there was no American embassy there at the time, and found out that we were both considered in Iran to be only Iranian citizens, and there was nothing anyone could do to help us. No government agency could help us because we were Iranian citizens. So she called the embassy from the shopkeeper's phone, and he listened to the conversation and then said he wanted to help her. He said, you're in trouble and I want to help, so come back when you can and I'll see what I can do. And so he started this grassroots network of people who were trying to help us because they didn't, you know, they didn't want me to grow up thinking that all Iranians are like my father's family. And yes, it was a very lengthy and dangerous process. Even for them, they risked their lives. If they had been caught, they could have been executed. Their families could have been imprisoned or executed. Mm-hmm. And but even in an environment like that where it seems like there's no one you can trust, everyone is against you, even then God can provide, and that's exactly what he did for us.
Did your mom have a hard time trusting him, or did she kind of have an inner sense that this particular man was trustworthy?
She talks about that now, that it just amazes her that she did trust him. I think it didn't occur to her not to trust him.
Wow.
He said he wanted to help, and she needed help. But that was clearly the hand of God there.
Talking to Mahtab Mahmoudi again. The title of her book is My Name is Mahtab. So when we come back, we're going to talk about that whole dangerous trek to escape. Oh, my goodness. And what happened? What's happened in the years since Mahtab came back to the U.S.? More with Mahtab Mahmoudi when we return. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. My guest today is Mahtab Mahmoudi. She's the daughter in the film. You remember the film way back when with Sally Fields, Not Without My Daughter, when Mahtab's grown up and tells the story of her American mother and her escape from Iran and living under the fear that her father would find them again. At this point of the story, if you just tuned in, you got to go back and catch the podcast from the beginning and catch up because we want you to hear this whole story. At this point of the story, though, Mahtab, your mom was able to get to the marketplace on her own, where normally she was under the watchful eye of your father, and met a man who was willing to help her. Take the story from there, if you would.
Mm-hmm. So then over the next several months, we would check in with him whenever we could. Sometimes weeks would pass in between when we were able to communicate with him. And many plans were hatched and fell through. You know, there was a plan shortly before we did escape, where I was going to, mom and I were going to be whisked into a car, you know, on the way to school and secreted out of the country, and that fell through. But there were many plans. Some we were supposed to go through Pakistan, and some, you know, on a boat, and some on a motorcycle, and everything fell through. But he never gave up on us, and he always was working on something. The whole time he told mom that going over the mountains into Turkey was the most dangerous route, and he was really determined to find some other way for us to escape other than going through Turkey.
And there's a point where your mom's dad, I believe, if I remember right, was ill, and the family was begging your father, let them come to see him on his last days. And your dad finally said, well, she can go. Matab stays. And if I remember right in the story, there's a point where you started to feel like maybe your mom's betraying you, that she's making a plan to leave without you. What do you say?
That's true. That was maybe one of the most difficult times for me, because all along, you know, mom and I were in this together, and I had that rock. She was my rock. I knew that she was working so hard to find a way to take me home, and she wouldn't leave without me. And then finally, after, you know, my dad worked really hard to convince me that she really was leaving, and she was saying, no, she's not going without me. And he's saying, well, she is going. You know, we have the plane ticket. She's packing. You know, she's going. And mom was saying, but I'm going to find a way to take you. And you know, I didn't believe her, because I knew then that he really was sending her, and he wouldn't let me go. So that was a tough time, because up until then, I didn't trust my dad, but I could always trust my mom.
And so what changed that for you?
Well, the day that we left our house, mom and I left our house, there had been a bombing, and in Iran, we didn't have a car. Everything was rationed, even getting a car. There was a lottery system to have a vehicle. And so when there was a bombing and my dad would have to go to the hospital, the ambulance would come pick him up. So the ambulance picked him up, and he never left us alone. There was a neighbor woman who was there, and so she said she would stay with us. And mom convinced her that we were going to someone's house for dinner, and we needed to get flowers, because there may have been a war going on and everything was rationed, but it would have been unthinkable to show up at someone's house for dinner without a bouquet of flowers.
Hmm.
One of the beautiful aspects of the culture.
Hmm.
And so this woman took us to the flower shop to get flowers. And when we got there, mom got out of the car and insisted that she and I would walk home. And this woman didn't want to leave us. And finally, mom got her to leave. And instead of going into the flower shop, we went straight to the phone booth and she called the man who had been trying to help us. And she said that we couldn't go back, you know, that we had to find a way out now. And that's when I finally understood that, you know, she was doing everything she could not to leave me, that she was not betraying me. She was still faithful to her word. She would never leave without me.
Hmm. And at this point, this is where I got to in the book, and I had to come in here. I had to come in studio to do this interview. I'm like, wait a minute, I got to know what happens next. So I remember her stuffing her bag, and something slipped out, and you gave it to her, and she stuffed it back in, and she said, you know, we're not going back to the house. That's as far as I got. So take it from there, if you would. Was this the catalyst to your escape, or did you end up having to go back home after this?
Well, this really is the catalyst to our escape. So when she got out of the car, and a skirt fell out of her bag, and a man on the street stopped and picked it up, and she already was walking away toward the phone booth, and he handed it to me. And I thought, well, how strange, there's a skirt in her bag. And so I, you know, ran to the phone booth and handed it to her, and she just stuffed it back in. And so she said that, you know, we weren't going back to the house, but even then she didn't want to make the decision for me, because she knew that meant I wouldn't see my dad again.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said, I don't know when or if I would, you know, you would ever see your father again. And I started to cry. And so she thought that I didn't want to leave. And so she would have, in that moment, gone back to the house.
Amazing.
Knowing that she would have been killed. And because this is what, by this time, things had escalated to that point. He was saying, you know, this is the last day you'll see each other. He was going to kill her. He told her how he was going to kill her, and he was going to send her body back, cut in pieces, back in a box with the burned American flag over it, and, you know, these kinds of things. Yeah, and but I was crying because I wanted my bunny. Yeah. I didn't want to leave.
Big difference.
I didn't want to leave without my bunny. Big difference.
Yeah. But as a child, it's probably hard to make, well, I want my money. I know I'm going back into a war zone. But your mom, again, her grit and her love and even respect for you to say, okay, if we go back, we might not make it out again. But she empowered you to be able to make a decision. And finally, mm-hmm. you said, no, I want to go. Let's go.
Mm-hmm. It is. I don't think I've been asked if I would do the same thing. And I think I'm too headstrong, and I think I would not have given anyone else that option. If I were out, there's no way I would have given someone else the option to have a say in the matter. But she did, and it was genuine on her part.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And what do you remember about the trek from there on in? And you see that in the film, Not Without My Daughter. As a young girl, what do you remember about each leg of that journey? Were you in constant trauma, or how did you feel? Did you sense God with you at all, or how was that for you?
Well, I think so much about my life was so bizarre, and so much of it was just, I looked at life in such a matter-of-fact way, and I think that was, you know, God helping me through all of this, that these things that should seem so traumatic and just paralyzing, that I experienced them in a very, very matter-of-fact way, not overly emotional in any way, just, all right, this is what's happening. How are we going to deal with it? What are we doing here? So we left, and from there we took a cab to an apartment across town, and the man who was helping us met us there. And then we were there for several days while he made plans. And we really did end up having to go the route into over the mountains into Turkey, which is what he really had hoped wouldn't be the case. And then it was in winter. January 29th was the day we left the house in Iran, and we celebrate as our Freedom Day. And this January 29th, we'll be celebrating our 30th anniversary of our Freedom Day.
My goodness! But,
yeah, it's been a long time. So from there. Drug smugglers, this man who made the arrangements, he paid himself. He spent his life savings to hire drug smugglers to take us over the mountains into Turkey. And the roads were closed because of the snow in the winter. And even the smugglers didn't use that route this time of year, but it's all that could be arranged. And we weren't able to travel on the roads because we didn't have permission to travel. So most of the time we were walking and on horseback going over these icy mountains. And as we approached the Kurdish section, there was a Kurdish civil war going on at this time too. So as we were in the Kurdish region, then mom was given Kurdish clothes to wear so we could, you know, try to blend in. And we stayed with the Kurds. We slept one night in a stable it's just amazing how God used these people, and they couldn't have been kinder to us. They really treated us so well, and they too risked their lives to help us escape. It's just is amazing to me. I think so often we see something going on in the world that we don't agree with, but how many of us would risk our lives to do something about it? And so many people risked their lives to help us.
Amazing. How long was the journey from the day in the phone booth to the day that you stepped foot on American soil?
Let's see. I made out a timeline when I was writing the book. I can't remember if it was 5 or 7 days. I think 7 days until we were back. Maybe 5 days until we were out of the mountains, and then 7 days until we were back home in America.
Did you have any trouble getting through customs and getting into America?
No, I don't remember having any trouble with that. We finally made it to the American Embassy in Turkey, and then they helped arrange for our travel back. Oh, and by then we had passports because we had passports that were not validated. So until we arrived at the embassy in Turkey, and then in Turkey, the embassy validated our passports, and then we could legally travel. And there, our American citizenship was recognized, so we didn't. And once we were at the embassy, then it was smooth sailing.
Amazing. The man that spent his life savings to help you, did anything ever happen to him? Do you know anything about his life?
I don't know anything about him. He said the only payment he wanted was to know that there was a smile on my face. And
my goodness.
We were able to get him a message at one point since our escape that there was a smile on my face. But I don't know where he is now or if he's living or if he's well. Yeah.
You know, you asked such a good question. How many of us would risk our lives? I mean, I think of Corrie Ten Boom, a Dutch watchmaker who risked her life for the Jewish people. And, you know, how many of us would really do that? And think that God assigned certain people along your pathway to give you safe passage. Not easy passage, totally dangerous passage, but you got to U.S. We're going to take a break here in just a moment, our final break. But talk about the reunion with your friends and family in the U.S.
Oh, it was a great homecoming. My grandpa had this tradition. He would wait at the top of the stairs. There was a bathroom right at the top of the stairs coming in his house, and he would wait in there until I was near the top of the stairs and jump out and yell boo. And he was very, very ill when we came home. He weighed 80-some pounds, and he was just a skeleton and very, very frail. None of the doctors thought that he would have lived this long, but he was so determined. This is where Mom gets her determination. He was just determined to wait for us. And so he had some relatives carry him to the bathroom, and he waited there for us. And yeah, and leaned out and kind of whispered, boo. And my grandma had pies waiting for me. My family didn't know we were attempting to escape when we did. And so from Turkey, we called and told them. And Grandma, I put in my order. I talked with her on the phone, and I put in my order for all the pies I wanted. And when we got home, the kitchen was full of pies.
Oh, it's just an amazing story. When we come back, Mahtab, I'd love to know just a little bit about what life was like for you after that and the years that followed. An update on your father and your mother. Do you connect with your dad now? Those are some of my questions. Got a few copies of Mahtab's gripping book. You won't be able to put it down. It's titled My Name is Mahtab. Email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Put Mahtab, My Name is Mahtab, in the subject line. Give me your mailing address. We'll pick a few of you to get a copy of this absolutely amazing story. More when we come back. The Lord delights in every detail of your life. He's near to the brokenhearted, and He will never, no, never forsake us. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. My guest today is Mahtab Mahmoudi, and she's the daughter in the film. You remember the film with Sally Fields, Not Without My Daughter? If you've not seen it, go rent it. It's gripping. You'll forget to breathe. Well, Mahtab has grown up now. Her mom escaped. Her American-born mom escaped with her from Iran, and really out of the threat of murder, out of the threat of utter danger. And if you just tuned in, you've got to go back and catch the whole story. We just have about 8-9 minutes left, so I want some updates if we can. So you left us with, you know, your homecoming, your grandma made your favorite pies. You're at this point, I think, 5 or 6 years old. Take us into the years that followed, because the threat wasn't over. You moved a ton, and you lived under the constant threat of abduction and fear. Talk about what that was like for you.
We very much thought that my dad was around every corner. He vowed that we would never escape, but if we did, he would spend the rest of his life looking for us, and he would kill Mom and take me back. And so it was the thought of being mom and I being separated was very scary because we were a team. We needed to be together to protect each other. And so it was a wonderful thing when God gave her this opportunity to write so that she could stay home with me and be with me and get settled in, make sure everything was okay. When I did start school, so I was 6 when we escaped, and when I started school that following fall, I ended up at a Lutheran elementary school. Mom thought if I went to a parochial school, it would be smaller and the teachers could, you know, keep a more watchful eye over me. And, you know, again, I see God's hand in that. He was leading us there because it was there that I really learned to live my life again. And after our escape, I was very angry and bitter. And I not only hated my father, but I hated anything that reminded me of him, his country, his language, his, you know, this heritage that was always going to be a part of me. And when mom recognized that, she really worked hard to help me find the good in him and find the good in this heritage that was mine. And also at school, at the same time, the teachers taught me about Joseph. They taught me about God and his protection, and that even if my dad did kidnap me, you know, he couldn't take me away from God's love and his protection. And and they taught me about Joseph and forgiveness and all of these things. And so all of these lessons came together really and made a huge difference in the quality of my life after our escape, because there was still this fear that my dad would come and find us. But then in the midst of that, there was also the peace of knowing that God is with us no matter what.
Did your grandparents ever receive threats? Did your mom ever hear from your dad?
I vaguely remember getting a call at my grandparents' house. I don't know if it was somebody else calling. I'm not sure. But he was very quiet over the years. The first time I got a message from him directly was when I was 16, 10 years after our escape. And the message was, you know, that you are Iranian, you have the genes of Fatima, and I will not allow you to be anything but Muslim. And, you know, we would get messages that the FBI would contact mom and say that there's a threat or, you know, there's a plan to kill you. This is how you're going to be executed. There's nothing we can do to protect you. Things like that. The Iranian government issued a threat. She was going to speak in Canada. So the Canadian Secret Service provided security, and she went on with the event. There were definitely threats over the years, but they were more distant until I was 21, and I was a junior at Michigan State University, and my dad was working with a producer from Finland to make a documentary telling his version of our family's experiences, and they're quite different from what I remember. And they really wanted to film a reunion, so they were quite persistent in their efforts and had a student working with them as an intern, but basically turned into a stalking situation. The student was basically, he was very determined to help facilitate a reunion, I guess is one way to say it. So that was a difficult time. And my dad said in a message then on our answering machine at mom's house that I was 21 and I could think for myself. And he wanted to tell me the truth because what I'd been told was lies. And my response was to turn to mom and say, well, did he forget I was there?
Right.
Because I remembered for myself what had happened.
And what it felt like. I mean, the difference between school clothes and you're coloring in a coloring book and you're only allowed to color with certain colors and the indoctrination and the brainwashing. It's a marvel. I mean, I just was reading what you were enduring and what children and families endure under that culture. It's just amazing. We just have about 2.5 minutes left. I got to know, have you had any contact with your father?
He died in 2009.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But up until the time he died, he was very determined, you know, trying everything he could to reestablish communication. But I put a lot of thought into it. I prayed about it. And Mom was very open to me communicating with him. I was the one that was so consistent through the years about not communicating. And I really took him into consideration when I was making these decisions too, because, you know, he wouldn't have gotten the closure he was hoping for. He wanted a relationship. We never would have had a relationship. There was nothing I needed from him. I didn't expect him to take responsibility, and he wouldn't have. So I think that would have just made him angry, and it would have been hurtful for him. He was dangerous when he was angry, and I didn't want to hurt him anymore. So,
how about your mom, Mata? How's she doing?
Mm-hmm. Oh, my mom is wonderful. She's great. She's doing very well. She's here the day my book was released in America, and we had so much fun. We went book hunting that night. We drove around to all the bookstores in town and took pictures of the book on the shelves. We're very close.
Mm. So with your father having passed away, did you still have any kind of fear with releasing the book with family members and just even just because of the nature of your story? I mean, do you feel ever in danger, or is that sort of past for you now?
Well, I hope it's past. I look at the state of the world now, and I see that people are doing such extreme things for causes that they may or may not, you know, really be involved in. And so there's always reason for pause and for caution. But ultimately, you know, we need to live our lives not take any unnecessary risks or try to incite danger, but you know, there comes a point where you just have to live by faith and keep moving forward. So indeed. I hope that those dangers are over and
So Mata, one last question before I wrap us up and I pray for you. How do you pray for our nation?
I pray for God's will to be done. I think that we're so blessed to live in a country where we have these freedoms. And I guess my fear for our nation would be that in the name of security, we give up on what makes America America. You know, the liberty, the freedoms that we have. You know, we don't want to sacrifice those in exchange for feeling more secure. And I think that when there are people in the world trying to instill terror, if we then turn our back on others, or if we turn away from the values that make America a great country, then we've given the terrorists the victory, because we've given up what makes this country great. So I pray that we get back to our values.
Well, Mata, this has been just a powerful conversation. I wish you God's best. I just want to wrap up and pray for you and for this book. And Father, I just thank you for Mata. I thank you for her story. Thank you for her unbelievably brave mom. I pray you put that kind of courage in our hearts, that we would stand in the gap. You ask us to do that for the voiceless, for the defenseless, for those who need a hand. I just pray, God, help us to be in the right place at the right time, to stand in the gap as you would for those who need your help. We pray a blessing on this nation. We beg your forgiveness for the countless ways we've departed from what's best. And we ask you, may your kingdom come and will be done in this nation, in our hearts, through our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, Mata, God bless you, dear sister, and thank you for this time today.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
So good to talk with you. You've been listening to Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson. In just a little bit, you'll find a podcast of my conversation with Mata up on our website at myfaithradio.com. Remember, if you want a chance at a copy of this book, email me. Put "my name is Mata" in the subject line. Give me your mailing address. You might just be one who wins a copy of this great book. Don't go away. Another great hour is up ahead. Hour 2 is up next.